This is a podcast from BBC Radio's news and sports station,
5Live.
To find out more about 5Live and its sister service, 5Live Sports Extra, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.
Andrew Collins, hi.
Hello.
We are going to have a trilogy, though. I've came up with that as the Collective Nine, a trilogy of film reviewers. I have a little clip to play from Mark Kermode, and we'll hear from James King a bit later. We're doing this because of the email we got earlier. We're going to drop off the last letter of film titles.
It's a great game.
The Incredible Hulk. Don't make them angry.
That's good.
Ferguson, North York's Apocalypse No.
I've got that one. Does that ruin it if somebody else has got it?
Yeah, do yours first in case.
Well, I was half listening out there. Have you had Watch Me?
No.
Yeah, well, I think that would be a good film.
Three Men and a Boa. I'm not doing the other one on that list. It could be a bit rude. I'm not sure. Keep them coming in to 85058. Falling Die would be quite good in terms of the economic situation.
Pertinent.
Thanks to Tim, the librarian, for sending that in. And Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pear. That would be a bit different. Now, before we begin, Andrew, I have some unfinished business with Mark Kermode.
Yes.
The man who doesn't like television, remarkably, 2 weeks ago, accepted my gift, I've been working on him for a year, of a Curb Your Enthusiasm box set series one.
Perfect.
On air, people heard it, the nation heard it, people around the world heard it who listen online, that he promised to watch it with an open mind. So I felt touched by the sacrifice he made. It was a real moment in a blossoming relationship. So he left a message earlier today, which I assume will include his thoughts on Larry David and Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Colin, hi, it's Mark. Listen, a couple of weeks ago you went out and you spent your own money very kindly to buy me the set of Curb Your Enthusiasm. You gave it to me and you said, go away and watch it and give me your verdict, which I promised that I would do. And it was really kind of you, particularly since you spent your own money. And I promised I'd ring you and let you know what I think. And so I'm just doing that to say I haven't watched it, sorry.
You dog. You
dog. Well, it's his loss, Colin. Well, it's your loss monetarily, but his loss culturally.
It was the hang-up hurt the most. That was the knife through the heart. The hang-up. I didn't mind anything else.
That was a mistake. He didn't mean to do that. He just kind of put his elbow on it by mistake.
Now, you know the way Kermode and Mayo are like Crockett and Tubbs and stuff like that.
Yeah, and all those things.
I've asked people when they email in 85058, sorry, that would be the text, or email mayo@bbc.co.uk to try and do sidekicks.
Because
substitutions or deputies.
Yeah.
So, for example, Gene Wilder's character in Blazing Saddles was a deputy, so it doesn't always have to be disparaging and insulting. Now, this week's movies we're going to look at, 17 Again, 50 Dead Men Walking, Fast and Furious and the 400 Blows, but first, also Race to Witch Mountain. But first of all, let's do the UK box office top 10 with Andrew Collins. At number 10, it's Watch Me.
Watch Me.
I'm going to drop the letter, okay?
Yeah, it's just me. That's what it is. It's a film about me and you have to watch it.
Okay.
For hours and hours and hours, directed by Zack Snyder. It's a bit of a come down for him after 300, but it's just a film about me. She's still doing pretty well, considering.
The problem, of course, was some of this was leaked and all sorts.
Yeah, it's a huge movie for people who like grown-up comics, which I do as well. And, you know, nothing will ever be good enough for those people. They're worse than people who read novels, people who read graphic novels. They are much worse because they're more attached and also they've got visuals to look at. People who read novels imagined it, so they're really insulted when somebody makes a film of their favourite book. But with graphic novels, it's even worse.
I have to say, I haven't seen it yet. Everyone tells me it's wonderful. Gran Torino still in the top 10 at 9.
Yes, that's good. And in fact, that sounds like a title that's had a letter taken off. It should be Gran Torino. But Gran Torino is the name of a car, and it's Clint Eastwood's car. It's a really interesting film, this, but it's a bit like two films for the price of one, because there's a kind of weird Disney film in the middle of it, and at either side there's a film which is about, basically, he could well be Dirty Harry retired, character he plays.
Do you agree with Mark Kermode that the problem is with Clint Eastwood, he's so good at what he does, he can make a film and look like he's not trying?
Possibly, but in this he plays comic, and he hasn't done that for a while. Now, even though it's a serious film and it has serious things to say about race and bigotry, it's a comic film. He's an old man, and he hates his kids, his grown-up kids. They want to put him in a home, and he sits there at the kitchen table and he goes, which is just hilarious.
When it comes to Clint Eastwood, it's not comedy unless a monkey's involved. I'm going to stick with that.
A monkey having some kind of cruelty meted out to it.
Now, number 8, which I went to see on Sunday, Duplicity.
I'd like to know if you like this, Colin, because I really didn't.
I couldn't stay until the end.
It was so irritating.
I don't leave movies early. I'm sure Clive Owen's a wonderful man.
I bet.
But I didn't really get an idea of what he was saying, whether it was serious, funny. emotional. It seemed to all be coming out in exactly the same way, and I really love Julia Roberts, and I always have. That's coming across quite camp there, but I love her.
So do I. I love her as well. We're both camp. I think she's great, but this is such a letdown because she's not been around a while. She's been bringing up her kids. Admirable woman. But this is from Tony Gilroy, who made Michael Clayton and wrote the Bourne films. He's a really good screenwriter and can direct. We've seen him direct Michael Clayton. This is just too clever for its own good, which sounds like I don't like clever films. I love films that challenge me. This film just made me just sit there with my mouth open. Yeah. People did leave. I went to see it in the cinema and paid, and people did leave before the end because they could not take it anymore.
Dull.
Yeah.
At 7, The Damned United. It's good to see it doing so well.
Terrific. And I am one of those boring people who've read the book, as a lot of people will have done, about Brian Clough. It's not like the book. The book is an intense, mantra-like, repetitive interior monologue of Brian Clough, fictionalised. This is much more of a tribute to him. And unfortunately, Brian Clough's family don't want to go and see it because they don't like the book. But actually, I think they'll probably be pleasantly surprised. And Michael Sheen, once again, inhabits a living... Well, not living anymore, but living at the time, a real character.
At 6, and I want to see this, Paul Blart, Mall Cop.
Yes, if you like Kevin James, you might like it. It's a broad comedy about a man who runs a shopping centre.
Is it rubbish, but has one or two lines that really make you laugh?
I think it will make you laugh and bring out your inner child.
Good.
It's people falling over and chasing and stuff like that. You know, if you like the old Keystone Cops films, you might like it.
There's not enough of that going on. At number 5, The Haunting in Connecticut.
Yeah, controversial horror film. Controversial in the fact that they didn't let the press go and see it. Critics weren't allowed to go and see it. Mark Kermode himself had to go and pay to go and see it.
That's always a good sign.
Yeah, he's the expert on horror, and I will defer to him usually in areas of horror. He says it's not too bad and he can't understand why the film company didn't show it to the critics. If you like kind of ghost stories, it's supposedly true, but so is the Amityville Horror. You have to just suspend your disbelief.
At number 4, Him and the Dog, Marley and Me.
I'm a cat person, Colin. I quite like dogs, but I've never owned one and I don't think I'd have the time. But if you're a dog person, and a lot of people are, you've got to go and see this. It's based on a best-selling book. It's about the life of a dog and how the dog's kind of 10 years on this earth coincide with various important events in the life of Owen Wilson and Jennifer Aniston.
It's interesting you say that, because a mate of mine is a dog lover. He's he's extreme dog lover to the point where he's obsessed with
dogs.
He
loves extreme dogs. Or
and he said it was the only dog he ever wanted to die because he couldn't wait to get out of the cinema.
Well, there you go.
At top 3, we'll start with Knowing and we'll do some emails on it. First, dear Stan and Ollie... from Mark Harrison, not being too bothered one way or the other by Knowing, I decided to rely on the good doctor's review to determine whether or not I'd go and see it. This was a terrible mistake, as I think Knowing is an early contender for the worst film I'll see this year. Besides being another unintentionally hilarious effort, that's exactly what it is, hilarious effort, from the most versatile actor ever, the ending was absolutely terrible. Without spoiling it in the time-honoured Wittertainment fashion, I'll just say that it's much more out-of-the-blue twist lifted from the climax of a certain blockbuster sequel last summer that Dr. K professed himself to hate. Another Knowing email. Dear the good doctor, Mr. Mayo, we'll take it.
Yeah.
This comes from Barnaby Walter. It says, I saw Knowing yesterday and was appalled at the script. Damages Rose Byrne needs to rethink her movie choices as she muttered one of the most ridiculous lines in recent movie history. In response to one of Nicolas Cage's doom-laden predictions, she goes all teary-eyed and murmurs, I know some caves where we could go. You know what? I don't want to be perverse here. I'm really glad that they're here because I said that it was the worst film I've ever seen and I'm not overstating it and I'm not being sort of rampantly extreme, but I genuinely believe this was the worst film I've ever seen and encourage people to see it for that reason, for lines like that. What do you think?
Well, I can't take Nicolas Cage seriously anymore. I can't imagine there was a time when I did, but I used to. Also, his name, he's taken the last letter off his first name, hasn't he? In the spirit of the game.
Yeah.
Nick, it sounds the same though, it's pointless.
At number 2, The Boat That Rocked.
Yeah, so much goodwill in the room for Richard Curtis and this film about the pirate radio station on a ship. And it's full of charming performances. And it's not a film you could do anything other than smile throughout. But it ultimately doesn't add up to very much. There's not really much of a plot. There's a kind of ending tacked on to make it slightly exciting at the end. Doesn't really work. It's just a series of happy little vignettes.
We're getting some emails on it. Dear Danger Mouse and Penfold.
Yeah, Penfold was better than Danger Mouse, so that's fine.
Why would you be Penfold?
Well, I assume you've got to be Danger Mouse. You're first. Your name comes first.
You can't just claim him like that. I'll give you Penfold if you'd ask.
Anyway, I want him.
My good girlfriend and I were discussing the merits or not of Richard Curtis films a week or so back, and we came to the conclusion that The Boat That Rocked is a bit rubbish. Our attempts, we feel, Sorry, our attempt, we feel far more apt, given the rather poor drubbing it has been getting, is making waves. So many connotations can be derived from such a title. Waves as an ocean, radio waves, political waves, or waves in the reviews and opinions of it. Let's do another one on the boat that rocked. Dear Ripley and Jones, was randomly invited to see the boat that rocked last night. Not something I would normally pay to see at the cinema, especially after The Dyer Love Actually, yeah. And was completely charmed by it. Came out knowing that it succumbed to many of the pitfalls of Curtis films, but I just didn't care. I liked it more than I was prepared to when I went in, and it was a genuinely pleasant surprise, says Will, BA Honours, Communication, Culture and Media.
Can I be Jones?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll give you Jones. We don't have any of we don't have any name in that one, so I'm not going to bother doing that. At number one, Monsters versus Aliens.
Yes, well, you know, you've got to see this really over the school holidays if you have young people, or if you're old and you want an excuse to take a young person with you, not a random one, obviously one that you know and are related to.
Take yourself out there, yeah, Andrew.
An alien comes down and monsters are called up, you know, to go and fight the alien. It's exactly what it says in the title.
Simon Mayo twittered about this yesterday, that he had to pay extra for the 3D glasses. I think if you
really
go and see a 3D movie, you should assume that we didn't even have to pay for them in the days of when they did it at the Nightmare on Elm Street film.
I didn't
stuff.
Have to pay for them when I saw Friday the 13th Part 3D. That's shocking. Well, that's don't go and see it then. Boycott the film. That's what we say.
Go outside with placards.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll come up with some no 3D fee for me. That's not bad.
It's
for a placard
good,
off the top of my head.
What do we want? Free 3D glasses. When do we want them?
Soon.
Now.
Films, Andrew, where you dropped the last letter off. Doug in Hambledon says The Magnificent Seve, which is actually now the ultimate golf biopic. Jurassic Park. Sam Neill and Jeff Goldblum attempt to play a round of golf avoiding velociraptors and Tyrannosaurus. That's from Tom in Liverpool. Thank you very much.
They're
for
all golf themed. It's good.
Why not? The Masters are on. Bernard O'Leary says, what about The Lady in the Tram? Or I like this one. It's just all the romance is lost by losing one letter to this film. Romeo and Julie. Alien.
Are you saying that Juliet is a more romantic name than Julie? What about all the people out there listening called Julie?
It's probably just a more romantic name because of Romeo and Juliet,
isn't it?
It's
his fault, isn't it?
If he had called it Romeo and Julie from the start, then Juliet wouldn't make sense. Yeah. Alien. That's the sequel to, Alien from Damien. Thanks for that. Kingdom of Heave from Jack in Blackburn, and John Carpenter's classic from Marcus in Houston. He says, The Thin.
Or Halloween. Or my favourite disaster movie with a duck theme, Earthquake.
Earthquake, yeah. Love it. Now, Race to Witch Mountain, because Earthquake would probably be made by Disney. This is a big Disney movie out this weekend. It's been a massive hit at the US box office and stars Dwayne Johnson, who, of course, was also The Rock. And I spoke to Dwayne earlier this week, so let's just listen to a little bit of that. I asked him, was it a fun film to make?
Yeah, I got to tell you, you know, it was a great experience for me. And the fact that, you know, we were able to make a movie that, you know, it was frankly just a lot of fun. And, you know, we wanted to thoroughly entertain audiences. And you talked about Disney. You know, I wanted to work with the director, Andy Fickman, again, who directed me in The Game Plan. Yeah. And, you know, the fact that, you know, Disney puts out movies that usually inspire a lot of hope and optimism in people, and the fact that tomorrow's going to be a better day than today. And that's what Disney, I believe, and Andy Fickman do very, very well. And I wanted to be a part of that again.
I mean, I wasn't a fan of Knowing, which, you know, had extraterrestrial beings and all sorts of things, and many, many more millions of pounds, it seems, spent in effects. And this did it just so much better for me. How much did you get to do in the film, Dwayne? Because you fall down massive chutes. There's car racing. Obviously, you did your fights because we can still smell what The Rock's cooking. But did you get to do much of the other stuff? That must, you know.
You indeed do smell what The Rock is cooking. Yeah, I was able to do all my own stunts in this, which I was very excited about. It just reminded me of how cool movie making can be. I had never been in a movie that had such intense action car chase sequences and car crash sequences. So for me, I was able to get in my cab and go 80, 90 miles an hour, bang my car around with those other stunt drivers. And that was really, really cool. And I like that. And plus, on top of that, I think from an audience standpoint, when I watch a movie, any time that the lead actor can be the guy performing all the stunts for me, I could always appreciate that. So, again, anytime that I could do that and have fun and kick some ass and make people laugh along the way is always a cool thing for me.
Dwayne Johnson, a.k.a. The Rock, on Race to Witch Mountain. Mark Kermode's not here. Andrew Collins, you haven't seen it.
I feel ashamed.
That's all right, because it can be one film in the world you haven't seen.
One I haven't seen.
Right, let me phone a friend then. I'm going to do that. James King.
Hello.
Ah, you see, there's always one about when you need him. No, I was not expecting to like or enjoy this movie. I had to see it at 8:30 in the morning after a very late night, and it really surprised me. Did it surprise you? Were you expecting something good, or did you hate it?
Well, you know, true to form, I'm kind of middle of the road on this. Well, the reason is, right, because the Rock, I'm a massive fan of in movies, and he's been one of the major surprises, I think, Dwayne Johnson, over the last 5 or 6 years since he went from wrestling into filmmaking, because he's a really charming actor. And, you know, he does that thing with the eyebrow, but he's, you know, he's very funny, and I think it's great. This is why kids love him in stuff like The Game Plan, is because he is this man mountain. But when he's being funny, that's great to see someone that tough and that big being silly. Mm. We saw it with Arnie. You know, Arnie did the same thing in the 90s. But I think my main problem with this is that actually in this, The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, is sort of navel-gazing in it. He's a man with issues. He's a man with a dark past. Yeah. And I think kids might be a little bit disappointed that we don't see wacky Rock. We see Troubled Rock. And I think Troubled Rock is perhaps a little bit more dull than Wacky Rock.
But do we not see a cynical Rock who then becomes... first of all, he falls in love. Second of all, he strokes kids' heads. That's always good in a Disney film.
Yeah.
And they've seen this with The Rock. You see, James, you've let me down with your knowledge of WWE. He's been Bad Rock before.
Yeah.
And he's came back and been Good Rock.
But I don't. I've kind of lost what you're saying. I don't. What? So you think that this is about his sort of? He's starting off as one thing, but by the end of the movie, he becomes something else. So it's about the passage of time and how he changes.
He's back to our Rock again at the end, and I loved that when he had tears in his eyes. I think they rubbed onions. I don't think he's that good yet. He can cry on cue. But
obviously, you know, he's an actor now, and no actor is going to want to be doing the same thing over and over again. And this is, you know, this is not just with The Rock, it's with anybody. You're in a very weird position where you find success in the movies doing one kind of thing, and then you say, well, actually, I kind of want to stretch myself a little bit now and do something a bit different. Mm. And I can utterly see why he would want to play someone who, for a kids' movie, does have a bit of a dark past. I don't necessarily know, though, for the Easter holidays, and for me, whether that's what I want to see him do.
Mark Kermode said to me earlier on the phone that he thought it was better than the original, because the original, actually, people romanticise about it. It's not that very good at all. But I've read real mixed reviews on it.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, it's kind of a classic three-star film, which is, it's absolutely fine. I do think the kids are quite good, actually. They're obviously the aliens who arrive on planet Earth, and The Rock, as a cab driver, sort of unwittingly picks them up and then finds that he's looking after them and has to get to which mountain of the title. And I think it's absolutely fine, and there are some good chases in it and some reasonably good special effects and a couple of gags. There's a few gags at the expense of the believers, the UFO fanatics, because this is set in Vegas and there's this big convention going on. So there's a couple of nice things in it. I just don't think that it's perhaps, compared to some of the other kids' movies that are out at the moment, you've just been talking about Monsters versus Aliens, or you'll mention 17 again in a few minutes. It's just not as good as those. It doesn't quite have the sparkle and the magic of those.
Well, it's interesting. It's a good time then for kids, because I'd swap them the other way around. I've seen them both, and I would definitely recommend Race to Witch Mountain above 17 again. But I think you're absolutely right, James. Both are good for the parents to take their kids to, and the parents won't be bored. I love to think of what the fathers who've been to Vegas will be thinking of those opening shots, as opposed to what the kids will be thinking about for their memories, you know?
Yeah.
You've got 42 seconds, James, to think of a film when, if you drop the last letter, it becomes a completely different film, and those 42 seconds shall be filled with a clip of Race to Witch Mountain.
Couple of kids, big wad of cash. What could go wrong?
We know you're frustrated, Jack Bruno.
No. No more Jack Bruno this, Jack Bruno that. I've been asking for answers.
You already know the answers, Jack Bruno. My brother and I are indeed not from your planet.
Nonsense. So that's it? Mystery solved! You two want me to believe that you're both aliens?
It is the truth.
Really? Well, you don't look like aliens.
Well, what does an alien look like, Jack Bruno?
You know what aliens look like. They look like little green people with antennas and laser guns that take me to your leader, Earthlings. Ooh.
He thinks we're insulting his intelligence.
You think?
You know, that's maybe not the best clip. But you can't hear action. You know, you can't hear action, and that's what the film's all about. James, how did you do? It was only 42 seconds.
How about a series of movies about superheroic mothers? Batmar, Spider-Mar, Supermar.
Very good. I had Anchorma earlier, so we can take it to the seas, and that's going to be perfect. Thank you very much, James.
See you later.
Much appreciated. A trilogy of film critics. That's
good. So,
is that new? Is that, have I invented that?
Yeah, there's, but there's been a pair before. Yeah. We've seen a pair, but never a trilogy.
I like a trilogy.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about this just quickly before travel. Warner Brothers have confirmed Liam Neeson as a star in Clash of the Titans. It's the first film, of course, since the tragic death of Natasha Richardson. He's going to play the king of the gods, Zeus. Was that Laurence Olivier?
I think, and I've got no information in front of me, that this film came out in about 1981 originally. It was a kind of the back end of the Ray Harryhausen kind of animated creatures era, and I imagine now it's all going to be done digitally. But yes, I believe I'm right in saying that Laurence Olivier played Zeus in that one.
So Liam Neeson to play that role in that remake of Clash of the Titans. We're going to look at a film called 17 Again, which is Mr. Zac Efron, the stud.
Yes, the screening that I went to see this at in the week was you'd expect screenings to be made up of dour middle-aged men complaining about films. That's what critics are as a rule. It was full of girls, young girls, younger than 17, because clearly, as the magazine Just 17 was aimed at girls who were not yet 17, this is a film about a 17-year-old Zac Efron that's aimed at people much younger than 17 who aspire to be 17 and loved him, I imagine, in all three of the High School Musical movies. And this is a vehicle for him. And yeah. I thought, because the girls were really excited, they were coming in, it was a screening that obviously either competition winners or whatever, and they were really excited. One of them, I heard them coming in, said to the security guy, she said, "Is this just like a normal cinema?" And he said, "Yes, very nice cinema, but it's a normal one." And they were all giggling and running and screaming, and I thought, it's going to be murder or brilliant watching this film with them, the target audience. And I thought they were pretty quiet throughout it. Really pretty quiet. I thought there'd be there was a little squeal when he first came on, Zac Efron. When he first comes on, he's got no top on because he's about to play basketball and he hasn't yet put his top on. He's forgotten to put it on, and they get to see his top half. And they were squeal, but not much squealing after that and not very much laughter. It's a comedy, and I just thought that the kids there will be mad for every single syllable of it. They seemed a little bit subdued, I thought.
I think to start a film aimed at teenage girls with Zac Efron in a masterstroke, though, the first scene, literally, as you just said, is in the school gym and he's shooting basketballs with no top on. Game over. The girls are going to see it twice.
He's good at basketball as well, because he's obviously, it appears to be clearly flipping the ball up into the basketball hoop. In the idea of the story, it's a body switch comedy. Basically, what are we going to do with Zac Efron? Well, let's put him in something that's a bit like Big and a bit like Vice Versa, a bit of Freaky Friday, and frankly, a bit like Back to the Future and a bit like It's a Wonderful Life. All our favourite films. It's bound to be good. Well, he is the 17-year-old version of Matthew Perry. And in 1989, when he's doing his basketball match, and he's, is it a match? I'm not very good at basketball.
Match, don't worry. Yeah, match up. It's on a match up.
On the basketball court. See, that's right, isn't it?
That's good.
There's a scout there, and if he plays well, this scout's going to sign him up, and he's going to go to a career of professional basketball stardom. And he blows it, because he has a conversation with his girlfriend, and it turns out the conversation involves her telling him that she's about to have a baby. And so he runs out to have a conversation with her and blows it. And then we fast forward to now, and it's Matthew Perry, and he's a loser. His wife, who he did marry, has kicked him out. His kids don't like him. His teenage kids won't even talk to him, and he's just about to lose a promotion. So he becomes, through magic, 17 again. So he becomes Zac Efron in the present, but his mind and everything inside there and all his memories are from the 40-year-old version of him. Okay, so in this clip, there's a lot of complicated stuff ensues. This clip as Mike, as played by Zac Efron in the future, but in the body of a 17-year-old, talking to his own daughter and telling her not to go out with a school bully.
What do you want?
I just want to talk about Stan.
Yeah?
Why are you dating him? I mean, you know he's not a nice guy. He's crazy.
Hey, don't say that about Stan. You don't even know him.
Oh, but I do. I really do. I know him better than you.
Look, we're moving in together after graduation.
Stan got into Georgetown?
What?
What?
No. No, Stan got on the management track at Home Depot.
Oh, great.
And I'm going to Westwood Community College to be closer to him. He's my forever.
There's no way in hell that's happening.
Excuse me?
I said there's no way in hell that that is happening. You think I'm going to let you mortgage your future? You're going to let you throw away all your hard work? Everything that you've accomplished for some guy, some psychopathic guy who doesn't care about you? I forbid you. I forbid you to see him anymore.
Oh, okay. Who the hell do you think you are, my father?
Ooh, bit on the nose, that line. Yeah, bit on the nose. This ought to have been okay. The films that it wants to be were good fun. It's something kind of amusing about a 17-year-old boy having the mind and the vocabulary and the thinking of an adult. And he talks the school bully down by, you know, psychoanalyzing him and all the things that an adult knows about the school bully. He says all these things to the school bully and wrong-foots him. So there are moments in it which are not bad. I can see why Zac Efron is much loved. Do you agree? He's a charming individual. Yeah. He looks
good. He's a nice guy as well.
Yeah, I'm sure he is. And, you know, he deserves better than this, I think, and he probably will get better than this. I imagine the people who love him probably would rather have seen him singing and dancing in it. At one point, he does join in with the cheerleaders and does a bit of a dance. Clearly, he's a very good dancer. He doesn't sing in it. So, in a way, he's clearly not going to want to keep making High School Musical for the rest of his life. But this is a kind of transitional film, which maybe should have made it in private, just to practice, and then make another film, and we'll see that one instead. Do you agree? It wasn't as good as it could have been.
Average best, but good for the kids.
I don't think it's brilliantly directed, and I think it's brilliantly written. You know, it'll pack them in, I'm sure.
Okay, let's look at Fast and Furious.
Yeah, well, this is the bizarre thing, which is a fourth film in a franchise which comes between the second and the third.
Love it.
Right? It's very complicated if you haven't seen the original Fast and Furious or the other films. But basically, the first one, it's about streetcar racing, illegal streetcar racing, which took place in Los Angeles in the first one. Mm-hmm. And it was Vin Diesel, who was a streetcar king, versus the cop, who's played by Paul Walker. That was the first one in LA. I saw that. I don't really care about cars, personally. Do you?
I'm not big into cars.
People love cars. I know people watch entire TV programs about cars and will continue to love this, however many they churn out. But then the second one came out. That was moved to Miami. Paul Walker moved to that one. Vin Diesel didn't star in that one. Then in the third one, which was in Tokyo Drift, Vin Diesel makes a cameo at the end. And they realised we need to get Vin back for the fourth one, and he came back. So it's good to have him back. Whatever you think of him, he's a bit like The Rock in the sense that he's a huge individual. He's escaped to Vin Mountain. He's huge, and he speaks very slowly, and that's obviously how he is. You know, I think that's what he's like in real life. I don't think he speaks in a kind of Rada accent when he's not on screen. But it's basically about racing and drugs. There's drugs involved. The cop is now in the FBI. There's a bit of rivalry. If you're interested in the chronology of the story, you'll find out that the guy who's the main driver in Tokyo Drift, that story is kind of kicked off at the beginning. There's a character who's in the first one, I won't say which one, who dies in this one. And so, you know, if you're interested in this story, you'll want to see this part.
You're watching it for the fit bodies, male and female, the fast cars.
Everybody's glamorous. Everybody's good looking. The car sequences are brilliant if you like car sequences. It's probably not aimed at me. I felt much happier in 17 again than I did in this, really.
Have you seen Death Race?
Yes.
I enjoyed that because that was more mindless.
It was, actually. This one has its moments of, you know, there's stuff about being loyal to your friends and all that kind of stuff.
No need for that.
There's a lot of soppy stuff in there. Vin Diesel can't do the soppy stuff, I'm afraid. Yeah. But there is a clip we can hear, which will be them talking. There's one of the few points in the film where they talk. It's Paul Walker and Vin Diesel talking to the drug lord, who's played by John Ortiz, who we last saw in American Gangster.
How's your car? Took a nasty bump.
It'll be ready.
I also heard you just got out of county.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
You know a guy named Jim Garcia?
No. Big place, lots of names, lots of faces. And you? You're wanted by a lot of people, Holmes?
Yeah, that kind of heat can't be good for business.
Yeah, well, that depends on how you look at things. I go down, I do time. I do real time. I don't know about your other drivers. But when I see flashing lights in my mirror, I don't stop.
Do you know each other?
He used to date my sister.
I see. You're a lucky man.
How's that?
You're still breathing.
Yeah, I think I'd rather heard the car noises.
Yeah, the car noises, squealing tyres, that's what you want to know about.
Looking forward to this one, 50 Dead Men Walking.
This is a film with some substance, at least. It's written and directed by a Canadian called Carrie Skoglund, but it's a Northern Irish story. It's a real-life story based on the book by Martin McGartland, who's an informer, or a tout, as they're called, against the IRA in Belfast in the 80s, actually, rather than in the 70s. But it's, you know, the way it looks, the moustaches, the look of the place, it could be in the 70s, you know. And it's one of those gritty, violent films that's a slice of life as life was, I'm sure, if it's based on his account. Although I think they've played a few liberties with it.
Always is with this particular genre and this particular situation. There's always a bit of controversy.
Absolutely.
About
I mean, and it doesn't take sides. They always say that. We're not taking sides. You know, there's violence on both sides of the divide. Jim Sturgis, who is English, does, I think, very good Northern Irish accent. You probably be a better judge than me, but I think it's pretty damn good. I was quite impressed by it. He's very good in it, Jim Sturgis. He was in that awful Beatles film, Across the Universe. So thank God he's got something decent on his CV. But oddly enough, the type of film that this is has now got a set of cliches.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, even though it's a serious subject and a serious thing to be making a film about, there are things in it which you've kind of seen a lot of times. Now, in a way, that's not a criticism. It's just unfortunate. You always see a kneecapping and that kind of stuff. So you feel like you've seen a lot of it before. And Ben Kingsley plays the special branch guy who's not Northern Irish. He's a Yorkshireman, and he brings a bit of gravitas to it.
Hi, Sir Ben. His but performance.
Yeah, he's all right. He can do these. He's got a wig that's very, very well stitched into his head. But it's quite grim. So you've got to be in the mood for it, really.
Okay. Not a film to go to on sort of a Saturday afternoon.
Not a
looking a bit
movie.
Of light relief. Stick
no.
to Race to Witch Mountain for that.
Yeah.
We've got a couple of emails that have come in, Andrea, about something that Mark Kermode and I talked about. Dear Richie and Scratchy, listened with interest to your debate on Slumdog Millionaire, book versus film, and wanted to draw an interest in comparison with last year's Best Picture Oscar winner. I thoroughly enjoyed Cormac McCarthy's book No Country for Old Men, but thought the film was rubbish. It completely missed the point of the novel. Quite a feat, considering the screenplay was virtually a word-for-word copy of the novel. And then I get this one here. Dear Dirk Diggler and Chess Rockwell, that comes from James, who says, listened to Mark's film reviews with Colin Murray several weeks ago and was struck by something Colin said about Slumdog Millionaire not living up to the novel on which it's based. This line of argument is used so frequently about film adaptations, it never fails to wind me up. I think part of the reason is that thinly veiled under all such comments is a lazy snobbery about the inherent value of film in relation to literature. He's made a list of some that are better.
Okay.
And the list I thoroughly agree with.
Right.
But I'm sorry, James. Read Q&A, which very few people did, and the film rips the heart out of it. But you're totally right in saying, I trust The Exorcist is a given, Blade Runner, Breakfast at Tiffany's, The Talented Mr. Ripley, Jaws, Trainspotting, Psycho, The Shining, Carrie, About a Boy.
So these are better than the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, The Shining is definitely... What Kubrick did with The Shining is find a story and take it out and turn it into his film and concentrate on different things.
Blade Runner.
That doesn't make it better, just makes it different to the book.
Yeah.
Stephen King believed that his book needed to be done literally and made his own version of The Shining, which wasn't as good.
But this list, you know, Jaws, Psycho, Trainspotting, all did justice to the book, at the very least. He's right, all of these did.
Trainspotting is a brilliant book, but it's just a load of little stories. And what John Hodge did was knit them all together and make a whole out of it. So, you know, you can have a brilliant book and a brilliant film that are totally different.
But I'm afraid, James, Slumdog Millionaire does not do justice to the book. Maybe there is a lazy snobbery of people who think if it's not written down the page, it shouldn't be cheapened by being made into film. I'm certainly not one of those people.
You're not a lazy snob. You're a hard-working snob.
Yeah, there's a big difference.
Completely different.
Thank you very much. Continue to take the last letter off film titles when Mark and Simon are back next week because it will confuse them. Andrea, it's you. Don't say anything to Simon and we'll just get them all to come back.
Okay. What about the film 30?
Love it.
Just 30 Spartans.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.